climate chaos means humanity on the move.
By 2070, 2 to 6 billion people will be displaced from this ideal habitat that supported human life for the past 6,000 years. And that's different from saying 2 to 6 billion people will migrate, but it gives an indicator of, you know, how many people will face severe environmental stress of the sort that from, you know, the beginning of human history almost has driven people to migrate. And I worked with those researchers to model what that looks like in the United States to get a little bit more granular about it. And what their data shows is that the climate niche has traditionally fallen around the middle of the United States and encompassed the entire country, but it is also shifting north toward, you know, towards the Canadian border and the Great Lakes. And as it does that, they calculate that about 160 million Americans will face dramatically changing environmental conditions of the same sort that, you know, have forced past migrations, that the southern part of the United States is sliding into the marginal zones of that ideal human habitat.
That's Abram Lustgarten. We talk with him about his book On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America. Then we catch up with journalist and author Ross Barkin about his recent article in New York Magazine, The Most Endangered Democrat in America. Jamal Bowman might lose his job over Israel. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, transcripts, and extended interviews? Here are some headlines just from today's May 22nd edition of The Washington Post. A hidden threat. Fast rising seas could swamp septic systems in parts of the South. Where heat waves might cause blackouts. A massive Antarctic glacier that could raise global sea levels by up to 2 feet if it melts is far more exposed to warm ocean water than previously believed. And brutal heat swells across Texas as many remain without power in Houston. Then there was Miami TV meteorologist Steve McLaughlin, who unleashed a scathing critique of a measure that would remove most references to climate change in Florida law, noting that April was the planet's 11th straight hottest month on record, and Wednesday's 115-degree heat in Key West was the city's hottest-feeling day on record. Both Texas and Florida are seeing heat index records fall, and it's only May. This is just the beginning of the world that Abram Lustgarten describes in his powerful new book, On the Move. It's about the global and internal migrations climate change is causing, migrations that will accelerate sharply as more of the planet falls out of the zone of habitability that has reigned during most of human history. On the Move is an account of what this massive population shift might look like. As Lustgarten shows, the U.S. will be rendered unrecognizable by four unstoppable forces: wildfires in the West, frequent flooding in coastal regions, extreme heat and humidity in the South, and droughts that will make farming all but impossible across much of the nation. No place is truly safe. But every degree of warning we avoid will buy us time to adapt. Abram Lustgarten is an investigative reporter writing about climate change at ProPublica and for the New York Times. His writing also appears in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and Scientific American. Abram Lustgarten, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Now, you've been reporting on climate for a long time, but this book became intensely personal for you when you began to question whether and when you need to move or not.
Yeah, it did. As you say, I've been reporting on climate issues for the better part of 20 years, and I'd been reporting on climate migration for a couple of years when where I live in Northern California was affected by a series of wildfires and the wildfire smoke. This was like 2018, 2020. And that process of going, traveling, reporting on climate-driven migration in places like Guatemala and El Salvador, and then suddenly coming home and finding myself and my family and my community so similarly disrupted by similar environmental change really forced me to reconsider, you know, what climate impacts mean for Americans and when it will also affect when Americans will begin to move and what I might do in the face of that as well, when I might also feel like I have to become a climate migrant.
Yeah, we're in the same boat. I live on the east end of Long Island. And while in some ways we will do better than many people in terms of the heat, we have a very, very high risk, of course, of extreme weather. So,
yeah.
You say in this book, On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America, you say the wheels are coming off the bus. As many as one out of three people in the world could be finding themselves in a zone that is unmanageably hot and dry, and that in the U.S., half of Americans will in fact exit the comfort zone. So tell us about this picture that you see coming down the pike, and also give us a sense of the time frame.
Well, there's a couple of studies that I reference, and they're published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and in the journal Nature, and they look at what they call the human habitability niche, and this is basically a climate niche, and they find that for the past 6,000 years, human beings on the planet have lived within a certain range of temperatures and precipitation, sort of an ideal climate. And they find that as the climate is changing now, that niche is shifting. It's physically moving towards the poles, north and south. And because the population and the landmass is weighted towards the north, that means that in terms of its impact on people, that zone is moving northward. So that study looked at how many people are displaced out of that niche, and it happens to be that the parts of the world that are falling outside of that ideal niche are also the most populated parts of the planet. So that study estimates that by 2070, 2 to 6 billion people will be displaced from this ideal habitat that's supported human life for the past 6,000 years. And that's different from saying 2 to 6 billion people will migrate, but it gives an indicator of, you know, how many people will face severe environmental stress of the sort that from, you know, the beginning of human history almost has driven people to migrate. And I worked with those researchers to model what that looks like in the United States to get a little bit more granular about it. And what their data shows is that the climate niche has traditionally fallen around the middle of the United States and encompassed the entire country, but it is also shifting north towards the Canadian border and the Great Lakes. And as it does that, they calculate that about 160 million Americans will face dramatically changing environmental conditions of the same sort that, you know, have forced past migrations, that the southern part of the United States is sliding into the marginal zones of that ideal human habitat.
So let's talk a little bit about what that means to people. What is that going to feel like to people? And I'd like to start with heat. You know, we'll talk about fires, we'll talk about water, talk about floods. Heat is the thing that has me the most frightened for some reason, because it's something that is relentless, you cannot get away from. Of course, unless you have air conditioning, but it means then you can't go outside. Talk about what kind of heat are we talking about in the southern United States? What is that going to mean in terms of life and in terms of work?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Heat is insidious. It approaches slowly. It's kind of smothering, you know, and its effects can be difficult to notice in some ways and until it's too late. And heat has profound, you know, physiological impacts on the body. So, you know, it's associated with higher rates of heart failure, for example, and exacerbates a whole long list of pre-existing conditions. And any sort of poor health, from diabetes to obesity, makes people considerably more susceptible to the effects of extreme heat. So we're seeing, you know, the entire continent, the entire world getting hotter. Its most dramatic effects are in the southern part of the United States. There's two sets of data that I analyzed for the book, and one was just temperatures rising. And that projects, you know, fairly extreme heat that we're beginning to see. I think we're all, you know, getting more familiar with now across the Southwest and the southern United States. And, you know, that suggests that the climate of like a Buffalo, New York will be approaching, you know, over the next couple of decades, what we used to think the climate of Tempe, Arizona was like. And then in places like Arizona, you know, we're already seeing these extreme heat waves these past couple of years, you know, 50 odd days above 115 degrees Fahrenheit, or, you know, a couple of days in 2020 when it was so hot in Phoenix, Arizona, that the air mass wouldn't support the lift on airplane wings and airplanes couldn't take off and land at the airport. So we are starting to see these extreme temperatures. And the second data set that I looked at is around what's called wet bulb temperatures, which is this intersection of heat and humidity, which doesn't require the same high temperatures, but if paired with moisture in the air, makes, we all know what those extremely oppressive humid days feel like. So this is really a measure of extreme humidity that can make it unsafe to work outdoors, unsafe for your kids to go to sports practice outdoors, let alone, you know, to recreate. And that kind of extreme humidity is going to spread across the southeastern United States and up through the Mississippi River Valley. So really cutting through the heartland of the country, you know, all the way up to Chicago, maybe not, you know, on a daily basis, but for a week or two out of the year. So, you know, Americans across the board are going to increasingly live with a certain number of extreme heat days each year. And those days are going to be increasingly dangerous in ways that'll have to keep us inside, force us to cool our factories, our homes, our offices, force us to take special care, you know, for the elderly and people with, you know, especially vulnerable health circumstances and things like that.
Now, you said a week or two, a year, maybe in a place like Chicago, but what is it going to look like in terms of that kind of heat in places like Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia, which is a city that you go into in some depth in this book, On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America?
Yeah. So I don't have my spreadsheets in front of me to give you some exact numbers, but roughly speaking, we start to see numbers like half of the year, you know, 150, 160 days of extreme heat in places like Arizona each year, a little bit less in places like Atlanta, Georgia, or in the Southeast, but a rising number, you know, of extreme heat days that start to, you know, push the envelope from being what we'd consider like a heat wave where we duck indoors for a week or two and talk about it afterwards, to something that becomes, you know, a regular feature of our daily existence, where it's every couple of days or a substantial portion of our year.
And so that would be one factor. I mean, people will want to migrate to cooler areas, as you pointed out. But then there are the kinds of extreme events like wildfires and floods and hurricanes that will displace people in a more sudden manner. I was just reading, I think it was either the Washington Post or the New York Times, that new studies show that in the last couple of days, I was reading this, the news reports show one of the most rapid sea level surges on Earth is besieging the American South. So talk about sea level rise and just how serious an erosion that is. And talk a little bit about some of the people that you met who are experiencing this.
Yeah. So the American coasts do see higher than average sea level rise globally. So we're experiencing in the United States some of the fastest rates of sea level rise. We already have, and we will continue to do so for the next couple of decades. I spent a considerable amount of time reporting in, you know, in southern Louisiana, and that's a place where there's an intersection of both land subsidence for a number of environmental reasons that are dropping the height of the land along the coastal areas, and then that rapidly rising sea levels. And it is accentuating the loss of land. The state of Louisiana has lost something like, let me find these stats for you, and I'll just tell you.
It's an ungodly, it's like two or three football fields in the time that you would read this page, I believe you said. Maybe.
Yeah, so this The state of Louisiana is losing about 2 football fields every 60 minutes. It's lost about 35 square miles of land each year for the last several decades. So it's lost an enormous amount of territory already. And along those southeastern coasts and the east coast of the United States, coastal flooding is happening 10 times more often than it did in 1960. So this is having a rapid and dramatic effect already. And I spent time in 2 communities in Louisiana, one called Ile de Jean Charles, which is an example of, you know, a forced retreat, a government-sponsored resettlement program that, because the land is being lost so completely, a new town was built about 40 miles to the north. And the people who live in Ile de Jean Charles have been given the option to move and have their move subsidized to this new town away from the coast. And that's the kind of forced retreat that we are increasingly hearing about, both being necessary and beginning to happen up and down our coastlines. I also spent a lot of time in the town of Slidell, Louisiana, with a woman named Colette Pichon Battle. And her family has been in this place for close to 300 years, so many generations living on this land. And as sea levels rise, it is their coastal bayou area outside of the town of Slidell has increasingly flooded. And she tells this really heartbreaking story of the slow realization that they would not be able to defend and reclaim their land. She went back home from Washington, D.C. to Louisiana to live there after Hurricane Katrina to try to help this community of Slidell rebuild and to bolster it, you know, against these long-term effects of climate change. And she describes to me this learning process over, you know, over years of studying this material and going to science events, and this realization that so much of their coastline was being lost and would be lost, that there was really no way to defend against it, you know, short of building more of the kinds of levees and seawalls that parts of Slidell have and parts of New Orleans have, but physical barriers at this point.
Yeah, and this book is also very much about who gets to move and who has to stay behind, or also who not just gets to move, but is forced to move, not just away from their community, but from their country. It's really about inequality. So talk about that frame for looking at the issue of climate migration.
Yeah, I mean, climate change in the United States, just as it will everywhere in the world, will prey on our vulnerabilities and our social vulnerabilities and inequality. And what that means in the United States is that, you know, poor people, in particular communities of color, also rural communities, will bear and are bearing, you know, the disproportionate impacts of extreme warming, of wildfire risk, of heat, even of, you know, hurricane devastation, and then of the programs to rebuild or come in and aid communities after disasters. And what that means, you know, long term, is that if we, from a policy perspective, aren't able to support the inequitable end of the equation, to support underprivileged communities in the face of climate change that risks not only harming those communities disproportionately, but destabilizing really, you know, our larger communities, because, you know, the more they become imbalanced, the greater risk of conflict, of difference between people who have and people who have not, and wealth and poor areas just becomes exacerbated. And, you know, some of the more dystopian visions that I hear about from the experts I talk to, you know, present, you know, an island of wealth in the midst of a sea of poverty in the United States if we're not careful to address those inequities.
Yeah, because you know, people listening to this program may think, you know, I care about those people, but that's not me. But you point out in the book, you know, in detail, the kind of economic destruction of communities that will throw more and more people out of work, cause them to lose everything that they own, throw them into poverty. Are there some examples that you can think of to elucidate that?
Yeah, well, I can explain the mechanism a little bit. And, you know, one of the data sets that I worked with from the Rhodium Group, the environmental and economic research firm, just looked at economic impacts across the country due to climate change in general. And it found that there would be great economic impacts along the southern part of the United States in particular, with some communities facing, you know, as much as 40 to 60% of a drag on their GDP. So that's sort of, you know, wonky and technical, but what it basically means is that counties hardest hit by climate change in the United States are going to be kind of permanently fending off the feeling of economic recession. And many of those counties are in poorest and more rural parts of the country. And the risk in these communities is that not only do they perhaps lack the resources to, you know, to defend against climate change, to invest in infrastructure, build seawalls or things like that, but that they will also, you know, be the communities that see an outpouring of more mobile and perhaps wealthier people first, right? So they'll be on the back end of that climate migration cycle. And when that happens, that can start a, you know, a degenerative cycle for a lot of these communities. You have a shrinking population, and that means you have a shrinking tax base and, you know, and fewer dollars flowing into things like, you know, the local school district, for instance. And as the school district is short funded, then the quality of education declines and more families, you know, look to that decline and so forth. So you get sort of a spiral of decline that can really collapse a local economy. And the risk is, you know, if that happens, or for the communities that happens to, everyone who can leave will leave, and the people who don't leave will, you know, will be the poorest and least able to, you know, to deal with these circumstances.
It is kind of like what happened to the Rust Belt, to be a kind of climate catastrophe belt.
Yeah, the boomtown analogy is, you know, is applicable and often, you know, often used. But I think that the scale, when we talk about, you know, climate impacts, the number of people and the number of communities affected, and the region that would be affected, is potentially much, much larger.
And so let's talk about food, because this was another terrifying part of this book. You talk about research that shows a decline in agricultural yields for every degree hotter that it gets, plus not to speak of drought and the disappearance of our water supply. So talk about the climate impacts on our food, and what are people going to do about that?
Yeah, I mean, between rising heat and diminishing availability of water, particularly in the arid parts of the country where we happen to grow most of our food, you know, we can expect that the agricultural industry in the United States and our food production and farming in general will be forever changed. You know, farm production in the United States has already dropped by more than 12% since 1961 because of warming, according to a couple of studies that I reference. And the researchers I talked to estimate that by 2050, by the middle of this century, the kinds of crop yields that were, you know, common during the Dust Bowl will become the new norm across the Great Plains. The heat will just decimate those large commercial crops. So the data that I used in the book looks at these impacts of crop yields on a county by county basis across the country. And it projects that more than 1,000 U.S. counties, which is more than, you know, about a third of U.S. counties, are projected to see their yields of big commercial crops decline by 2040 in some respect. And by 2080, that crop failure would spread to more than 1,900 U.S. counties, or more than half the country. Parts of the country, the desert Southwest, parts of southern Texas, would see a total decline in those yields of corn and soy, or about 100%. So they basically become unfarmable. And at the same time, you have severe water shortages, particularly in the Colorado River Basin, which is now used to irrigate cotton and alfalfa in southern Arizona, and also, you know, most of the country's winter fruit and vegetable crops, which are grown in Southern California. And it doesn't necessarily have to require as much water to grow those fruits and vegetables, but it will require, you know, a total cessation of growing crops like cotton or alfalfa. And so there's going to be, at a minimum, a need for a total reevaluation of how we grow the nation's fruit and vegetable supplies. Maybe those have to be grown increasingly in other parts of the country. And if they're grown in, you know, they're continue to be grown in California, then there'll have to be a very deliberate, you know, kind of reassessment of how water is governed, how much water is apportioned to those agricultural areas, you know, and how we choose to use it. Or right now it's, you know, really left to individual water users and individual farmers to, you know, kind of find the best course of action. And I don't think that's sustainable into the future.
Abram Lesgarten, in On the Move, you also go abroad. You go to Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador. You know, we know that even now, before the kind of climate migrations that you speak about in this book have even occurred. We have an explosive situation, a politically explosive situation on our border. More and more climate migrants are actually migrating north. Talk about what you discovered in Guatemala. You spoke to a Guatemalan family who suffered a terrible loss, and you know how the spiral began with the climate change.
Yeah, you know, it's important, I think, talking about climate migration to realize the impacts in the United States will be extraordinary, but they're also relative to the rest of the world, where those impacts will be far, far greater, and the world's relative wealth to, you know, to sustain the impacts of climate change much less. And, you know, so I went to Central America, which is one of several hotspots around the world identified by the World Bank as, you know, most susceptible to climate-driven migration. And I spent time with a number of communities in the mountains in Guatemala in particular, but also outside of San Salvador and El Salvador. And I went to try to get a sense of, you know, what kind of pressures finally, you know, drive a person to make the decision to move, what kind of circumstances lead to climate migration in an extreme scenario. And what I found defied my expectations, which was, you know, I thought that it would be a sort of a pragmatic decision making, a weighing of economic opportunities elsewhere in a place like the United States versus hardship in a local community. But what I found instead in Guatemala was just a total devastation of the subsistence farming and agricultural communities, with year after year of drought or irregular rainfall that made it just impossible for them to grow food. And so there were increasing rates of famine and malnourishment with children, and people were leaving as a result of that. And I spent time with two families that I write about in the book, and one is a family that for three seasons had difficulty growing enough food. And so their 16-year-old boy ultimately made his own decision to leave and to emigrate to the United States one day. And his story has a tragic ending, where he makes it to the United States, but ultimately has a medical emergency in U.S. custody. And before he's deported, he dies on the U.S. border. And the family at home in Guatemala is, you know, is devastated not only for their loss of their family, but the loss of, you know, the potential income and the potential labor, you know, that he would have contributed over the course of his lifetime. And I also spent time just north of there in a little farming village in Guatemala that had basically faced successive years of drought for 4 years running by the time that I got there. And just a month before I arrived, the head of one household left for the U.S. border, and he took his son because it makes it, you know, easier to emigrate to the United States. He recounted this story and his wife to me also of a year and a half spent trying to do everything they possibly could to share, to save their farm. So they had gone to the Guatemalan government with a farm cooperative and tried to raise $800 to build an irrigation system that would, you know, bring them water from a river nearby. They'd sought help from international aid organizations to sustain their farming. They'd sought food aid. They'd tried to borrow money to buy more seed or to enhance their farming. And at every step along the way, you know, they had failed to get a crop to grow to fruition. And they were basically running short on food, which forced him to leave. And it was just an experience of, by the time he left, it was total, absolute devastation for him and his family, and just a heartbreaking situation. And it was a lesson, you know, to me about how desperate many people are who are pressing up against the U.S. border. And as we look at this, you know, our immigration predicament and controversy at the moment, the numbers just suggest that, you know, what we're seeing is a new permanent state of, you know, of mass movement around the world. That I don't see any indication in the research that I'm reading and among the experts that I'm talking to that, you know, that the number of migrants in general and migrants moving for environmental reasons will do anything but continue to increase in the decades to come. And, you know, we can see how politically controversial that is and difficult to deal with. And I, you know, I think that that's going to be a long-term challenge that we're going to have to continue to sort out.
Yeah. And what struck me also, this is an $800 investment could have kept this farmer in his family on his farm. And yet our foreign aid has been slashed, and, you know, it was slashed by Trump, but It doesn't seem to me that Biden has increased it for these kinds of, you know, tiny investments that could actually solve this problem and not just solve a political problem for us here, but more importantly, solve a human problem for the people who are having to abandon their homes, their families, their communities, and their culture.
Yeah, you know, so often I'm asked, you know, what can we do in terms of both stemming the flow of, you know, of people displaced elsewhere, but also, you know, for people in the United States. And, you know, one answer is that it doesn't often take very much, you know, to make a big difference in stabilizing a community. And you mentioned this example, the man that I spent time with in Guatemala, you know, Juan Hernandez, who, as I mentioned, he lives kind of close to this. He lives about a mile from the Cajabon River, but he didn't have any irrigation equipment to move that water. And so even as there was water plentiful, you know, a mile away, he was losing crops to, you know, to drought on his farm. And yeah, that minimal cost, $800, would have, you know, given him the funds to build that kind of irrigation system. I spent time in El Salvador with a World Food Program effort that was similar and highly effective. For around $30,000, the World Food Program had built a greenhouse in a community in El Salvador that was also suffering from drought and had seen large numbers of people emigrate to the United States as a result. And for that small amount of money, the greenhouse was extraordinarily effective. It was allowing the community to build or to grow plentiful amounts of a variety of vegetables, more than they needed to subsist on. And so they were selling the excess, and the income from that was giving them extra income to, you know, support their community in a lot of ways, to build infrastructure, to buy animals, to have dairy, and all of these things came from a really small investment. And so, you know, that's the kind of thing that you could imagine the U.S. government or foreign aid programs, you know, engaging in the future that would be highly effective. But we've been slow to do that. The Biden administration issued a report about climate-driven migration about 2 years ago and still hasn't taken, you know, some of the minimal first steps that their own report suggests that they take. And those are things along the lines of enhancing foreign aid.
And is that something they depend on Congress to do, or is this something that can be done by executive order by the president?
Yeah, it's a mixture of executive order actions, of increasing funding for programs that we already contribute to, but that either need sustained long-term funding, United Nations funding, World Food Program funding. And then I'm not aware of specific congressional acts that are on the table or waiting, more the executive actions, but I'm sure that there are potential things for Congress to do as well.
Abram Lustgarten. Stay tuned for more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. We're talking with Abram Lustgarten about his book, On the Move. It's about the massive climate migrations, both globally and within countries like ours, that climate chaos will cause. Just before the break, we were talking about the U.S.'s failure to provide the necessary foreign aid to countries in the global south that are experiencing the worst impacts of climate change, aid that could help those countries adapt to those impacts and therefore lessen the pressure to migrate north. Let's get back to our conversation. You spoke to John Kerry, which is notable because, you know, what we're really talking about here is the issue that's called loss and damage. You know, when during the climate talks, you know, this has been the controversial issue. The global south is saying we need aid in the form of, you know, for the loss and damage that is being we're incurring because of the actions of the more developed world. And this is where the rubber has not met the road. And John Kerry himself really failed, I think. You know, this was the sticking point. The United States just did not want to get behind doing this. Why?
I don't have I'm not John Kerry, but having spoken to him, I mean, my impression is that it's, you know, his concern is that it's a slippery slope. And I think that is testament to the enormity of of the responsibility that the United States and the Western world has for, you know, for climate change and what's happening around the world. You know, when I spoke with John Kerry, he was both incredibly thoughtful about the implications of climate change and the implications of climate change on people's livelihoods and on the potential for large-scale displacement and migration. He spoke at length about how important it was to, you know, to aid communities in the ways that I'm describing, and also to avoid the kind of friction and conflict that can come from, you know, ill-conceived border policies or lack of border policies, and expressed, you know, I thought pretty, you know, prescient concern about what that means for the world. But you're right, he's been explicitly resistant to, you know, to taking full financial responsibility or deeply engaging in the loss and damage, you know, conversation. And I think that I think there's a real tension between what the true financial cost is and the ability or the willingness of, you know, of wealthy countries, including the United States, you know, to actually pay. And, you know, we talk about loss and damage in terms of the financial injustice and the great amount of money that the United States, you know, might pay for our disproportionate causing of climate change. But it comes up in the, you know, in the immigration and the migration conversations as well, because for the same reasons, right, the United States has emitted 25% of the world's greenhouse gases and, you know, ostensibly caused 25% of its harm. You know, there's a strong argument that we have a responsibility because of that contribution to also, you know, help avoid the displacement of peoples, not just the cost, you know, of climate driven disasters or damages to people, but to, you know, to help them remain at home where they would prefer to be and not to emigrate, you know, to the United States or to Europe from North Africa and elsewhere. So, you know, the argument, I think, is growing that we have a strong moral responsibility and debt. And it's hard to imagine if John Kerry is not willing to accept that responsibility, who will next?
And Abraham Lustgarten, in On the Move, you also talk about the economic benefits of dealing with the climate crisis, including, I would think, the kind of loss and damage that could go to the global south. I mean, people talk about how, you know, the global south can leapfrog over the carbon, the fossil fuel era into the clean energy era. It would be certainly a lot cheaper to do that than to let the kind of wars, conflicts, and general societal civilizational collapse that is in store for us if we don't do this. So talk about the economic benefits of dealing with this, not just at home, but also abroad.
Yeah, well, I mean, what we know for certain at this point, and there's not a lot that we know for certain, is that we're entering an era of, you know, unpredictability and change. And, you know, I think history shows that that can be disruptive, and it will undoubtedly be tragic in many cases, or most cases in terms of climate change, but that change also, you know, presents new opportunity. And in the United States, you know, I focus on what some of that opportunity might be for receiving communities that will, you know, see their populations grow. And this, you know, these might be, you know, Rust Belt cities around the Great Lakes with capacity to, you know, to take people who move increasingly from the southern United States. And so opportunity for them might look like economic growth, you know, prosperity and livelihood and energy that comes with a revitalized community, and that growing tax base to self-invest and create the kind of community, you know, for the future that they want. When you think about that more globally, there are no easy, I don't think it can be sugarcoated, or, you know, or we can suggest that, you know, developing countries can leapfrog, you know, into great prosperity just by using modern technology. But a little bit of help will go a long ways. And there are some opportunities there, you know, to lessen the pain, if not achieve, you know, some sort of nirvana. And again, I think it comes back to the same issues, you know, we were just talking about, which is, you know, enhanced and targeted and really intelligently allocated foreign aid that can help with an energy transition, you know, help continue to electrify, you know, the continent of Africa without, you know, first stopping at fossil fuels and, you know, and carbon-based fuels for that, you know, electrification process. So let's let's, you know, use some of our money to, you know, instead of paying loss and damages to pay for the impacts of increased carbon emissions, for example, let's use some of our money to lower those carbon emissions in the first place, you know, by buying and installing renewable energy that, you know, reduces the consumption of fossil fuels in Africa, for example. You know, and we can look at, you know, a number of programs like that. And those are certainly opportunities that I think we share a benefit in. We benefit if we manage to lower global emissions and do it quickly. And the recipients of that kind of, you know, aid benefit, obviously, by, you know, by speeding up their development and achieving greater prosperity with less downside damage.
Yes. And so finally, you know, what really struck me is kind of how the rich world and the poor world, the wealthy in one country and the less wealthy in that same country, are actually, our fates are tied up with each other. And you say doing what we need to do can buy us the kind of time that could ultimately stave off utter catastrophe. Say what you mean by that.
Well, for one, you know, the kind of projections that I see and that I use in the book for, you know, the number of displaced people, when we talk about 2 to 6 billion people sliding out of the climate niche, those same studies suggest that if we lower emissions sharply and immediately, that the estimate for displaced people might fall by 50%, that the number of people globally, you know, exposed to extreme unlivable heat conditions could drop by 80% if we were to achieve, you know, something on the order of the Paris Accord target for warming, which might be slipping out of realistic reach, but, you know, to give an idea of the magnitude of change. So from the perspective of lowering emissions now, what we do next really matters. You know, it underscores how much we still are empowered to shape, you know, our future and the severity and scale of all the impacts we're talking about. Sea level rise on the, you know, southeastern U.S. coast will still be determined by how quickly we reduce emissions over the next couple of years. You know, so I think that that's really, really important to, you know, to still focus on that opportunity.
Well, it's a terrific book, really a compelling read. It is On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America. Abram Lustgarten, it's just been great to talk with you about this. Thank you.
Really nice to talk to you as well. Thank you so much.
Abram Lustgarten. Read an excerpt from On the Move by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Ross Barkin about the most endangered Democrat in America. Stay tuned. Congressmember Jamal Bowman of New York is calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza and a peaceful solution to the conflict. That's made him a target of AIPAC, the powerful political fundraising arm of the pro-Zionist lobby. AIPAC has recruited George Latimer to challenge Bowman in the upcoming June primary. To find out more, we spoke a few days ago with Ross Barkin. He wrote an article about Bowman and his challenger in the May 13th issue of New York Magazine. Ross Barkin, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you again for having me. Excited to be here.
The title of your May 13th piece in New York Magazine is The Most Endangered Democrat in America. And it doesn't take too much to realize that it's about Jamal Bowman. The subtitle is Jamal Bowman Might Lose His Job Over Israel. First, just quickly sketch out for us, what is Bowman's position on Israel?
He is someone who definitely is on the left when it comes to Israel and the fate of the Palestinians. He also holds views that in some ways are very conventional. So I'll start with the fact that he supports what they call the two-state solution, a country for the Jewish majority, a country for the Palestinians. He supports conditioning military aid to Israel, which is fiercely opposed by the pro-Israel side, by a lot of Israel hawks. It's something Biden has now put on the table, but it's something that AIPAC and other strongly pro-Israel groups are against. He's someone who has been calling for a ceasefire in the ongoing war, which again is controversial within the circles of those who are very strongly supportive of Israel and believe there should be no ceasefire until all the hostages are released. And he's someone who's also willing to use language that activists on the left appreciate and conservatives and those who are strong Israel hawks do not like. So he's called the actions in Gaza genocide. He has talked about the suffering of the Palestinians quite frequently. And he has been willing to criticize the Israeli government, which is something more mainstream Democrats are doing. But since he is very outspoken, he's drawn a lot of criticism. And he's also someone, though, who I would not call anti-Zionist. And he has supported legislation in the past that has been Israel-friendly, like funding for the Iron Dome missile defense system. So he definitely is on the left on this issue. There's no doubt about it. You know, he's a progressive. He's critical of capitalism. He's allied to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He is very friendly with the activist class. But I would say generally he holds views on Israel that are not too far out of the mainstream. I would add in my interview with him, he expressed an openness or interest in the single multinational state, which would be one country for Arabs and Jews. That certainly is out of the mainstream, but it was more an openness and less of an official position, I would say. He was referencing a Peter Beinart opinion piece supporting the idea 4 years ago. That's how it came up. So, you know, that certainly puts him far on the left if you're endorsing a single state. But his official campaign stance is still a two-state solution.
Let's talk for a moment about his opponent, Ross Barkin. In your article in New York Magazine, The Most Endangered Democrat in America, you also met with George Latimer, the sitting Westchester County executive. Tell us about his position on Israel.
So Latimer is a unvarnished Israel hawk. Whatever APEC positions are, they're his positions, whether it's conditioning aid to Israel, military aid, he's against. And he would not even agree with the speech Chuck Schumer gave calling for new elections in Israel and taking aim directly at Netanyahu. You know, Latimer was not willing to endorse the speech by the Democratic majority leader, someone who is Jewish and is extremely pro-Israel, which is notable to me. And I think that indicated that Latimer, as a politician, is carrying forth the APEC line as much as he would perhaps argue otherwise. You know, he told me he had these views for a long time, and then these donors and these organizations decided to support him. He's been the Westchester County executive. He's been a state senator and assemblyman. He hasn't really been involved in foreign policy. So whether or not these views are earnest, the reality is there are millions of dollars being spent on this race, and there will be probably a lot more to come in these final few weeks, especially as super PAC money comes into play. And there's no doubt that this money, which will be spent to benefit Latimer and attack Bowman, is coming from the fact that he is willing to stand up fully and defend everything Israel does. Also, it has to do with Bowman himself. You know, Bowman has gotten himself into trouble. He has been involved in various controversies. He praised Norman Finkelstein, who is an anti-Zionist, at a panel. And so Bowman actually had to apologize for that, since he's not officially, at least, as a candidate, an anti-Zionist. And he's been in had some other issues as well, including pulling the fire alarm in the Capitol building and getting censured for it. And you know, you add up all that together, he becomes a very vulnerable Democrat. You factor in that Latimer has a spending advantage, and Latimer is not a slouch when it comes to campaigning. He's the current county executive. He's won many elections. He's very well known in Westchester. The district is parts of Westchester and the Bronx. He campaigns a lot. He shows up a lot. and that makes him very hard to beat. And even though he's technically the insurgent and Bowman's the incumbent, at this point, you can almost toss a coin in terms of who's going to win. And I think a lot of people wouldn't be surprised if Latimer ends up the victor.
You still think you can toss a coin? You think it's close, but not out of the question for Bowman to keep his seat?
That's not out of the question. I mean, the truth is there's not really independent polling. So it's hard to say. I think when you add up the money being spent on Latimer's behalf, the fact that he's won before, the fact that he's pretty well known, Bowman's controversies, the makeup of the district, I do think it makes it hard for Bowman to win. At the same time, you can't count him out totally. You know, he's still the incumbent. He is a dynamic politician. He is an aggressive campaigner. I think that he has a chance. And I am hedging because there's really no independent polling to go on. There have been a couple of polls, one tied to the Latimer campaign and one tied to Bowman. But without good data, I can't make too firm a prediction, but I think you could say that Bowman is endangered, and then you could say Latimer has a lot going for him right now.
Now, the Latimer campaign is being financed not only by AIPAC, which, by the way, is targeting progressives all around the country and often doesn't even mention Israel. They went down to defeat in their backing of the opponent to Summer Lee, who was able to pull out a win. But the other financing is coming from many of the same people who are trying to elect Donald Trump to the presidency. So talk about that tranche of money. Why are the Trumpists backing Latimer?
Yeah, I think some of that is just tied to Israel. I would say there are a lot of AIPAC or pro-Israel donors who are Republicans. I think beyond that, and I haven't spoken to these donors, so I can't say what's going through their heads. You know, Bowman is an inviting target. He is a proud leftist, a progressive. He's part of the squad. He's a close ally of AOC and Rashida Tlaib. So if you're a conservative, you know, the idea of removing one of these politicians from office, you know, this is a very exciting. And if you can really do this, you know, you're going to take your shot and try to do it. So I think that is a factor. And then I think also just Israel. I think there are a lot of donors who are willing to pump a lot of money into Trump and other Republicans who also will support Israel hawk Democrats like George Latimer. And you add that all up, you know, if you're a Trump backer, you might say, yeah, why not also send a max check to George Latimer's campaign? You know, if we can get rid of a politician that we really dislike and we think is wrong on the issues.
So what are the stakes? If Bowman is defeated, and by the way, I want to say that there are a lot of folks who are participating in the volunteer ground game to keep him elected. But what would a Bowman defeat do? How critical would it be as a setback to progressive forces in the country?
It would be a blow to progressives in the sense that they have been trying for the last 5 or 6 years to build a strong bench of politicians who can be influential in the national discourse and run for higher office in the future. And losing Bowman would hurt that cause. I don't think it's going to be a major setback for the pro-Palestinian movement, because I think the energy around it is already there. That's going to continue whether there's a Jamal Bowman or not. And I think that the squad itself and leftist lawmaking Congress is going to continue. There's going to be that group there. It may shrink in the next Congress, but new members can also join. So, you know, it's not the sort of thing that's fatal by any means, but it does hurt to lose a charismatic lawmaker, someone who has a real ability to motivate people. I think, you know, for progressives, not having Bowman there in Congress is a drawback. It also signals that the AIPAC strategy of recruiting primary challengers in Democratic primaries and funding them extremely aggressively can be successful. And Lattimer defeating Bowman could be a roadmap for challenges like that. Of course, it's easier said than done. You know, as I wrote in my piece, Lattimer is perhaps the perfect APEC recruit because he both will endorse every bill, every argument that the Israel Hawks make, and he will be their staunch ally. But he's also someone who is very familiar in the district, and he's someone who's not just about Israel. You know, he has a long track record of being a legislator, being an executive, of in most instances being a very conventional center-left Democrat. So if you're APEC, you know, Lattimer in some ways is that unicorn. He's someone who is not does not come off as an outsider. He does not come off as someone overly beholden to one interest group. You know, he can say with real validness that he is a born and bred local who has worked on many issues and has been earnestly involved for a long time. You know, those kinds of candidates are very hard to portray as usurpers or outsiders or wholly beholden to special interests. Whether they are or not, it's hard to make the argument when people all know him, they see him at the parades, they see him at the Little League games, they see him at the various dinners for all these different civic groups and organizations. And if APEC can find more candidates like that, they can win more races. And that might motivate them in the future to hunt down other, you know, well-known locals who are willing to endorse the most hard right positions on in Israel and run in these kinds of races.
Well, the article is really terrific and important. I think it's important for people to understand what is at stake in this race. Your title of your piece is The Most Endangered Democrat in America. Ross Barkin, thank you so much for talking with us about it.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Ross Barkin. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to his piece. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.